Hello, this is the Tympanic Eclipse. I'm Britt Ray. Artificial life, AI, ambient intelligence, playing God, removing the mystery of what makes life tick. Artificial intelligence researchers have long searched for the bare-bone ingredients that living systems require in order to be considered as alive. They get simulated in computational environments and grown from scratch, or made by copying pre-existing life forms in the lab. A closely related term that you can expect to hear a lot more about in the coming years is synthetic biology, an area of science that we are using to explore new ways to harness the natural world and the biological cellular entities it embodies into production factories that generate useful chemical and material products that we need. Fuels, medicines, rare food ingredients, you name it. Or at least, that's the dream that we have of it. It's a messy title, synthetic biology. Seemingly almost a paradox in its own nomenclature. An umbrella term that encapsulates within it several different approaches to designing and making human-created life. In this podcast, we explore some of the philosophical implications of trying to understand how to make life from the ground up that artificial life researchers and synthetic biologists have highlighted the importance of in their work.
Making artificial cells is an incredibly powerful tool for understanding more about the nature of life.
That's Mark Bedeau. He's a philosopher and professor at Reed College in Portland, Oregon.
Well, for the last decade, I've been the editor-in-chief of the journal Artificial Life, which is the kind of leading journal in the field of artificial life.
Anyway, back to his point.
The reason is very simple. It's that if you can make new forms of life in the laboratory, then you can manipulate them experimentally however you want. You have complete control. You can reprogram them however you want. Like add more stuff or less stuff or put it in new combinations or time the reactions differently or whatever. And normally what happens is you put all stuff together and you don't get anything else. You're not learning about life. But if you actually are getting life out, then you can figure out, well, what matters and what doesn't and how do things work. And, you know, you have this incredibly powerful tool. This is sort of encapsulated by this famous dictum that Richard Feynman wrote, you know, what I cannot create, I do not understand. And the sort of the obverse, the inverse of that is that if I can create it, then it really gives me a great way to understand it better. Maybe not, you know, you don't understand everything about it, but you understand a whole lot more. So that's a huge plus to synthetic biology, the potential to learn, to rapidly learn way more about life.
So Mark is saying that synthetic biology has the potential to really expand the human bank of knowledge for understanding some of the key questions that have been focal in the search for artificial life in the past. Namely, what is life, and how does it work? What does it need to exist, and how can it be manipulated? Giant questions that we sometimes exhibit too much hubris towards in terms of our potential to actually answer them. Nevertheless, the implications of asking these questions are fascinating enough themselves to just consider. I got the chance to talk to Rebecca Wilbanks at a conference earlier this year who studies these things. She's a PhD candidate in the program on modern thought and literature at Stanford University, and she's currently looking closely at synthetic biologists and artificial life researchers to examine how they view and shape the discourse around the definition of life in their research programs.
What I found was that in synthetic biology, at least in some parts of the field, there's a real engineering mentality. They're trying to make life easy to engineer so that we can use it to make things for us. And so what the kind of ontology that goes along with this is a kind of dualistic ontology, which I trace back to cybernetics.
And as I've mentioned before in a podcast, ontology is just the study of the nature of what exists.
The idea that the organism can be thought of as both a physical structure and also a message. So you should be able to completely represent that physical structure in the sequence of bases in DNA or in some kind of message that you could then manipulate on your computer screen so that you could modify it, design it how you like. I think that as it's often expressed, synthetic biology is more of what Pickering called an inframing technology rather than a revealing technology.
Which is a discussion that you can learn all about by listening to the Tympanic Eclipse episode that features Andy Pickering, found on this podcast's website.
I think that this vision is more really based on a mental model that we have that we then implement in the flesh.
What do you think is at stake when it comes to using mental models to predict the future? Do you have an opinion on that?
Yeah, I think what's at stake is that we overstate what we can actually do with biotechnology, because so much of synthetic biology depends on putting the context in place to ensure that things are how we want them to be, to ensure that our mental model gets actualized.
Do you see any alternatives, or do you have any methods in mind by which we might be able to step aside from this pitfall of overestimating what we can do when we're talking about the future? I mean, this is a difficult question that I think is what, for example, the critical artists that I'm interested in are trying to get at by opening up new modes of conversation with different publics. Mm-hmm. But how can it go beyond just discourse? Or is discourse all we need, mm-hmm. you know, to kind of bring about this other way of looking at how we're thinking about our technology?
Yeah, I actually think scientific inquiry is a great way to stay humble about what we know, because most biologists that study this stuff are very circumspect about what we actually understand. I think it gets harder when there's a lot of money involved, and when sometimes in communications to diverse audiences, a lot of the nuance gets lost.
Within synthetic biology that's focused on making artificial cells or synthetic cells, there are two fundamentally different approaches, which I'll call top-down and bottom-up. The bottom-up approach is also an attempt to make what I'll call proto-cells. So what's the difference? The top-down approach is, so the goal is to make a synthetic cell. Well, what does that mean? How would you do it? There are two basic ways to approach it. One is to take an existing living cell and modify it. That's synthesizing it. You're changing intentionally some aspect of it. Maybe a lot of it. Maybe most of it. And, for example, Craig Venter's team that's recently made what they call a synthetic cell, what they actually made is a synthetic genome, which is 1% of the molecular weight of a cell, but it's a really important part, and it's the part that controls a lot of other parts, and you can change and manipulate and program particularly easily. So that's an example of top-down. Start with an existing cell and modify it. Bottom-up is making a synthetic cell by starting with raw ingredients, none of which are alive. Typically, you just buy these from a chemical supply house, you know, amphiphiles in DNA or, you know, biomolecules maybe, but they're just molecules that you can buy from a chem lab or make yourself. And then the idea is to put them together in the right way so that the result, the whole system that results from them, is alive. That's the bottom-up approach to making synthetic cells. A minimal chemical life form would have three key chemical properties. It would have what I'll call a program, which is like the genes. That is to say, it's some chemical means, like DNA or something, of storing information that can, such that that information can control critical processes in the cell. It's not just information that's passive, it's active information. It's like, in this case, it produces proteins, stores information about the proteins, and then the proteins are catalysts, which are driving the chemistry inside the cell. So catalysts are a good example of what I mean by the information being active rather than passive. So that's P, the program. You need a metabolism, M, which is just a way to harvest raw material and raw energy from the environment and use it to assemble yourself and maintain yourself and, you know, feed the, stoke the the fires that drive the program's operation, etc. You know, it's the energy for the cell and the raw materials. And then now to have this happen in the real world, so you have this program, P, and you have the metabolism, M. So what is that? We're talking about actual chemicals. If you just stick them in some water, like a bucket of water, they're going to diffuse away. So you'd need another thing, C, a container. So the vision of minimal chemical life that most people in the protocell community share is this PMC model, program, metabolism, container. And so the idea is that if you can find any other chemical way, like a simpler chemical way to make a PMC system, where each, the P and the M and the C, they're all supporting and enabling chemically the other to operate. So it's a self-maintaining, self-organizing, self-regulating chemical system with a P and an M and a C that can reproduce itself and transfer information and evolve ultimately, because the information can be, there can be mistakes in copying the information. Then you have like a minimal form of evolution starting, and you can sort of see how that could be, you know, something like the key to life. Anyway, that's the vision that a lot of people have.
One problem for this ontology of life that's based on a kind of engineering paradigm is that it runs up against the problem of evolution, that life forms are not static, they're always changing over time. Where I saw this, the question of time came up more strongly was in Gerald Joyce's work. And he's an Origins of Life researcher who's trying to create artificial life. He's trying to create a system that he could consider alive out of organic chemistry. And so it was really interesting to me when I started following his work, because Joyce is credited with this definition of life that is known as the NASA definition. And this definition defines life as a chemical system that can undergo Darwinian evolution. And in 2009, Joyce essentially achieved his goal. He created a system. He and a postdoctoral researcher, Tracy Lincoln, created a system that met this criteria. It was a self-sustained chemical system that evolved, but he didn't consider it to be alive. And the reason was that it hadn't really done anything very impressive. It was just, they had kind of designed it to be able to replicate, but it hadn't created any new forms on its own, any new functions on its own. So when I was talking to Joyce about this, it became really clear that the idea that life needs time. You can't have living systems out of time. So as he put it, biology is chemistry plus history.
So, in this regard, Joyce updated his definition of life, the same one that he had created, which was adopted by NASA, where all you need is a chemical system capable of Darwinian evolution in order to call it life, to include the importance of time. He wanted to highlight the effects that duration has on bringing life to bear, because it allows for a life form to generate its own surprising behaviors and features through mutation that were not planned for in the initial human design system.
It reminded me of a quote by Bergson: time and deterministic theories doesn't really do anything, but real duration gnaws on things and leaves the mark of its tooth on them. So I like that way of thinking about the importance of time.
We evolved from some original form of life, which is something like, we're assuming, this PMC system, which is nothing but a complicated chemical machine. And so the implication is that we ourselves are nothing more than a complicated, much more complicated chemical machine. You know, so maybe it's a PMC with all kinds of epicycles, much more complicated, but it's what you do to get us out of that is just add more chemical complexity, basically. That's the way most people think about it. So you have a philosophical problem to figure out. How should you think about yourself, your own nature? How should you think about things that are distinctively human, like morality or freedom or, you know, consciousness or, what is all of that if we're just complicated chemical machines? So the point I'm making is that synthetic biology doesn't prove, but it lends a lot of weight to the conclusion that we, humans, are just complicated chemical machines, and that raises a variety of issues. Some of them are ethical, some of them are philosophical, but fundamentally I think the most interesting one is how should we view our own selves?
Rebecca and I got to talking about Freeman Dyson, the physicist and mathematician who has become well known as well in biotechnology circles for his musings on how biology will shape the future. Recently, he's been discussing what he deems to be the power of democratized biotechnologies and the promise held by the ethos of the DIY biology community, a form of recent civic engagement to de-institutionalize biotechnology and disseminate the knowledge of how to successfully run lab experiments to everyday enthusiasts.
So Dyson writes that domesticated biotechnology, once it gets into the hands of housewives and children, will give us an explosion of diversity of new living creatures rather than the monoculture crops that big corporations prefer. New lineages will proliferate to replace those that monoculture farming and deforestation have destroyed. Designing genomes will be a personal thing, a new art form as creative as painting or sculpture. So you could think of Freeman Dyson as kind of the patron saint of DIY bio.
Of course, as it's to be expected, the most common initial thoughts that come to people's mind about the DIY biology movement is the havoc it might wreak. By putting such powerful tools in the hands of average interested people, what futures could it bring forth? Biology is not as inert as the internet, so open sourcing its program to the same extent as what hackers have done with computers certainly worries some people. But anyway, regardless of the potential dangers, many people are working towards the utopian future of a distributed bioeconomy among everyday citizens, as Dyson outlined. DIY bio is just one facet of what might become the widespread accessibility of emerging biotechnologies, and subsequently, creation of novel life forms.
It's powerful. Synthetic biology is powerful. That's partly why people care. It can be used for all kinds of positive things. You know, you can make a lot of money. You can do a lot of good for society. If you're an evil person, you can also cause a lot of harm, too. So people have to pay attention to that. I think there's way too much attention paid to that, frankly. People talk a lot about it. I think for various reasons they talk about it. Anyway, I don't think there's a... I think if I were a terrorist trying to wreak havoc or an evil person, there are a lot easier ways to do it than getting involved in synthetic biology, frankly. So I think that's overblown, hyped, overhyped. But it's real.
I'm not sure if this vision really allows for the emergence of forms over time, if it really is bringing time into the picture in the way that Bergson was talking about, and in the way that Joyce is talking about, that time where you have the possibility of multiple potentialities of kind of open-endedness.
So open-endedness is an important concept. We all know that sometimes we feel victim to the spontaneity of life. It can whip us in new and surprising directions at the drop of a hat. Seemingly completely unplanned courses end up dictating our lives, and people we never imagined being connected to become our partners in crime. Similarly, biology and its manifestations also surprise us. The world, from its social to molecular scales, is an emergent system.
The basic idea of a definition of emergence is when the whole is more than the sum of the parts, and so the whole can be more than the sum of the parts. So I think life is the classic example of this. And so this is kind of closing the loop to the beginning of our conversation. To really resolve this question of, you know, meaning and purpose in life and, you know, consciousness, freedom, morality, love, all that stuff that's really interesting about human life, if we're just complicated chemical machines, well, it's the gist. Okay, you didn't put anything else in. Doesn't mean there's not anything else that is there once you put that stuff in and mixed it up and organized it in the right way. That's what emergent properties are. The whole is more than the sum of the parts, in some sense.
Well, there you have it. No questions answered, just more questions asked. Thank you, as always, for listening, and I wish you a very happy new year. May a lucky can of worms emerge for you.